What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to Get in the Trunk, Season 6, Episode 18. Major episode. It is, at least I think, the finale of our Impossible Landscapes campaign, which is just wild. Been playing it for a few years and actually seemingly coming to an end today, which is just amazing. I want to thank all of you, Troy, Sydney, Skid, Francis, for being with us through this whole journey. It's been awesome. You too, Nash. It's been really, really fun. Lots of fun stuff to come in today's ep, but I do want to kick it off with a little classic Delta Green weirdness. Delta Green is a creepy game in a creepy world that seems, in my opinion, unlike any other game, to kind of leak into real life in a way that can be kind of disturbing. I think we've had a few instances where we've been like, oh, this is a little bit creepy, and I think Delta Green is coming into my real life. Today, I am preparing for this session. It's a very big session, obviously, and it's early in the morning. I'm getting my kids breakfast, getting ready for school, you know, the usual routine. And out of nowhere, my wife is like, this is also going to reveal the record date of this episode. But my wife, out of nowhere, is just like, I hear in the other room, I can't find anything yellow. I need something yellow for the kids to wear. And I'm just like, what did you just say? And she, so this happens from time to time. The kids' school, there's always like, there's a thing. It's pajama day.
It's yellow day.
Wear your favorite team day.
It's the Yellow King Day.
Yes, exactly.
To honor
it was the King and Yellow Day at school. No, it was, they need to wear something yellow day because it is National Kindness Day. Today is National Kindness Day.
Yellow, which is the color of kindness,
a thing apparently. I don't yellow know at this school I guess it is, but we're scrambling through the kids' stuff trying to find something yellow, and I'm just like, oh, today's the finale of Impossible Landscapes. And it is creeping into my real life. Troy, do you plan on being kind to anyone today?
Kind? Why do I have to be kind?
It's National Kindness Day.
Oh, sorry, I missed that. yeah. Yeah, I'll be very kind. I'll be very kind.
That was not convincing.
Yeah, I got to think about it. Ask me tomorrow.
Sydney, I assume you've never heard of this.
National Kindness Day?
National Kindness Day, a day celebrated by many NGOs across the world. Apparently.
They make up a new day every year. Like every year there's a new day.
That's,
I remember,
true.
In high school, I worked in the like television production classes, and we had like a morning show that would show on every TV in the classroom that was fully produced by all the students who were part of the TV production. Yeah. It was so much fun. We were like news anchors. We'd read off teleprompters, and then we would also pre-film and edit like features and specials and stuff that would play. It was a whole production. It was really cool. And we would have like, what day is it? And we would make like a little short intro that's like, today is National Pancake Day. And we would make skits and stuff. And we would just Google like, what's today's thing? There's a thing for every day. Every day has a fucking thing. It's like National Pancake Day, National Find a Penny Day, National Tell Your Dad You Miss Him Day. It's just like every day has a thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like
Monday was Veterans Day. It's like, what the fuck?
What is that?
What is that bullshit?
There's always some bullshit they're making up.
I haven't heard of that. So no, I didn't know that it was National Kindness Day. But now that I do, you know what? When I'm in the grocery store, I'll let an old lady cut in front of me, or I'll reach for the high thing on the shelf for a small child and give him a lolly.
You sound so angry and mean about National Kindness Day.
Here's the thing. You should be kind every day.
Yeah,
you don't need
a
day to be like, ooh, I guess I should be nice to someone. It's like, you should do that every day. And yeah. I don't think you should make it a national holiday. It's weird.
Well, I mean, people say, but what about Mother's Day? I mean, you should be kind to your mother every single day. You don't have to, you're not going to buy her a gift every day. But like, there's a day that you do something extra special, you know?
I want to know what people would do today that is national kindness? Like, give me an example, I guess, Joe.
I could not make you roll any of the checks you have upcoming in this episode. That would be very kind.
Now we're talking.
Now I could just let you talk me through the end of your character story today without any die rolls. That would be very kind.
I love National Kindness Day. Have I mentioned that? I'm a big fan. Big, big fan.
By the way, Sydney, I do have to mention, I also was involved in our high school morning news team production. Nice. Loved it so much. I think it was WMCD, right, McD? McD's on the line, as always, with our Delta Green Games in the background.
He named it after himself?
I know.
He named it after himself? No, I went to Bishop McDevitt High School, and so it was also an MCD. But I think it was WMCD was the TV station. McDermott says, yup, I did the weather.
That is the perfect weatherman. Anchorman 3 right there.
Do you have any footage of this saved anywhere?
Please.
I'm sure somebody does somewhere. There had to be some priest somewhere kept a catalog of these things.
Little Joe and Little McD, like, hello, today, my name is Joseph.
Yep, I totally anchored, and McD totally did the weather. And we were also like, we were in Catholic school, so it was like shirts and ties, you know, every day. And so you actually looked like an anchor or weatherman.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Wear sport coats and stuff. Oh, so funny.
McD's out in a hurricane, like, yeah, the winds are pretty hard right now. Let's throw it back to you, Joe.
Good. Good stuff. Well, I want to get right into it here today. I think that we have we've got a finale to get to, and I don't want to waste any time. I want to give you guys as much time as you need to craft the end of your character's story in this multi-year campaign. It's very exciting to be able to finish something, to wrap something up. So many of our campaigns are so insanely long. It's nice to do something that isn't that, undoably long. And it's been great to have all four of you be here for every episode of this whole thing. Every one of these 55 episodes. This is the 55th episode of Impossible Landscapes. And so it has taken us 55 sessions to come to the end of this phenomenal.
That's crazy.
Phenomenal
That's
book.
Crazy.
Crazy. I still remember the day we were in the studio, in the old studio in New York, recording Giant Slayer during COVID and during COVID times. And I had this book on my table because it was sent to me by Arc Dream. And I was just, we were talking about it. And Troy was like, you should run this. And I was like, ugh. I just want to do operations, like, you know, single season operations. And then Troy came to me and was like, what about if we did it with Sydney, Skid, and Francis? And I was like, that sounds fucking amazing. I'd sign on for that for 3 years. And here we are. I can't believe that idea turned into this 55 episodes. Also, our first Delta Green content that went on YouTube. You know, so it starts at the Impossible Landscapes campaign is the start of the get in the trunk video aspect and everything. And it's been a wild ride. So excited
Guys,
to
hell yeah. put it can on we this. Can we stay friends even after we're done?
Totally. It's National Kindness Day.
Can we still record 30 shows together next week and the week after? Absolutely, Sid. No problem.
We've got to go to dinner or something. We got to have like a celebratory dinner.
We'll stay in touch over the summer. It's,
I'm sure. Have a kick-ass summer. Love.
Have a kick-ass summer. Okay. Let's do it. Brief recap. I always say it's brief and it's always so long. But last episode is part one of the masquerade. This is where you guys arrive at the palace, try to sneak weapons past the guards, and in some cases are successful, and get into this grand ball, this grand party, in a packed, huge ballroom, people everywhere. In fact, it is so overwhelming in a way that some of you get like kind of stunned by the amount of just sensory input you're getting between the music, the colors of the costumes and the masks and the dresses and the tuxedos, and the overwhelming Baroque sort of just chandeliers and huge paintings and golden picture frames and all, you know, all the painting frames and everything, all of this artwork and people and the din of conversation and dancing. And it's just very, very overwhelming. But you do, you know, have your own individual objectives, which I think are fascinating. Over the course of this campaign, this has gone from we're a team going after X objective to no one really knowing what the objective even is anymore until it becomes everyone's own individual objective. What are they here to do? What do they feel like their final purpose is in this mission, which has really drained so many of your emotional and mental stability to a point that you're barely recognizable from the characters you started out as when we started season four of Get in the Trunk. And so everybody seems to be doing different things. Neil is wearing a crown that was made by a child for him and seems intent to become the new king. Bobby is intent on becoming the like a guard or something, like to stand at the right hand of the king and ensure the transition to the new king. And all the while running into himself, it seems, because the Bobby we know is now embodying the identity of his father somehow. And he stares across and he sees himself at this party dressed as a witch doctor. Very, very strange, but he knows that it's him. And he treats him just as his dad would. Roger, trying to find a way to escape, moving from the outskirts of the party, looking through different rooms and areas, trying to find a way out of the palace before the king arrives. There are these murmurs and rumbling. The king is coming. The king is coming. Anytime now, the king will be here. And some of you get this feeling, this vibe. Like, it's a bad idea to be here when the king arrives. This could be very bad for you. Others of you think this is exactly where you're supposed to be, waiting here for the king. Vicky wants to escape, but will not do it without Sam. And Sam seems to be entangled in the machinations of Abigail Wright, the person who maybe we set out 3 years ago to save. But now here she is telling Vicky that she basically will not let Sam go until Vicky gives J.C. Linz his bottle. Who the hell is J.C. Linz? We've been hearing this name for a long time. Vicky meets him and he's just some dude with a briefcase who seems a little lost and is just hoping to get his bottle so that he can find the answer to his truest self. At the very end of last week, the king seemed to appear to Roger. The only reason that we can describe it as the king, whatever this thing is that Roger felt such an overwhelming psychological attack presence on him that was not entirely malicious, but it was like looking at the sun. The sun may not be malicious, but it will fuck you up. Like, that's kind of the vibe that he felt. And as the king passed by him, it handed Roger his bottle, a bottle for the first time with a plaque on it that said Roger Comstone and engraved into the glass, escape. That's where we ended last week. This week, we will open with a scene. I love scenes. I had to do one more before it was all over. We will hear the clitter clatter of silverware on plates, mugs on saucers, the sounds of a buzzing restaurant / cafe. And we fade up and we recognize the same cafe where Barbas met with Riker Salas in 2009. But this time, the cafe is different. Its interior design is completely different. It's from a different era. It's the style of its patrons, totally different. And it'll come up on screen. Washington, D.C., 1971. We come into the middle of a conversation where two people are sitting across from each other at a table, but we only see the front of one of them. We just see the back of the other. Don't know who they are. The person that we're looking at in front is a man, 40s, wearing a black suit, horn-rimmed glasses, or black glasses, and seems to be already in the middle of a conversation with the person across from them. And we hear this man saying, ever since this disaster in Cambodia, everything's been a little, well, honestly, better, if you ask me. I mean, less resources, yeah. More sneaking around. Meetings here instead of the other place, yeah. But no more oversight. And that's what I like. That's how I like to operate. I feel like that's how we're going to get things done. And it allows me the particular option of utilizing people like yourself. People that don't have an official designation. People that are off the grid, so to speak. Well, I want you to look into something for me. He reaches down, pulls up a briefcase, and pulls out a file. Passes this file across, and now we see this file being opened. And within the file, one of the first things that drops out is a photo. Two photos, in fact. And if you go to our VTT, see...
Oh, God. Something on the evidence board?
Yeah, to the evidence board. You'll see a man's image. It's extremely tiny and not... There we go. You see a picture of a man in a suit and tie, an old school hat on. Almost looks like a mugshot of some kind.
It's like Capone.
Yeah, it looks like Capone. Looks like Al Capone.
Is that?
And he's looking at this file, this picture sort of slides down, but there's a bunch of written stuff as well. And then we see the man across saying, this is Emmett Mosby, Delta Green agent. He was assigned to an operation, really non-glamorous one, in 1951. Was told as part of a project to go through some boxes that were confiscated by the U.S. Army during their operations in France during World War II. He's just supposed to catalog everything that's in there. Well, apparently, he finds some typewritten pages of a manuscript in French. He translates it into English, returns it to the file. Everything seems fine. 2 months later, he boards a boat to Europe for supposedly a spring vacation. He says, and this quote is in there, the continent first, and then on to court. His secretary wrote it down because it was so weird, very out of character. Well, he's never seen or heard from again. I don't know if anybody looked into this, but I came across this a year ago and it has been bothering the shit out of me. But we have no way. We have no official means to look into this, and I want you to take care of it for me. I don't know if this is a compromised agent hidden in Europe, distributing something that we're not prepared for. I want you to go over there and I want you to see if you can find this guy. Will you do that for me? And the camera pans around. And we see a 40-something Dr. Lyra Westover looking up at the man from the file as she just says, absolutely. Fade out.
Oh.
Wait, that was in 1971?
1971? Okay.
40-something Lyra Westover?
Okay, so this is... okay, so my notes. Mosby is absolutely part of the Night Floors. Henry Castine, there was like photos of blank expression people. There was Lintz, Darabondi, Bachman, Lundin, Mosby, Carver, Topchick. Then later, when we were at Barbas's house... I wrote down, Emmett Mosby gave Barbas the phone. Agent Mosby. Barbas met him at the bookshop in his closet. So Mosby is in the Night Floors. Like, Mosby is in the Night Floors. So he's absolutely compromised. Like, 1,000% compromised. Westover went to get him. Westover got stuck, too, I assume.
Yeah.
So everybody has been going to get the other agents, and everybody has been stuck.
Sucked in.
And it but seems to... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, if it's this Lyra Westover, like, we know her. Like, she would have been, like, in her 40s.
In the 90s, right? Or when...
In the
2000s. The 2000s, right. 2000s.
When we saw her at the hospital...
In 2015.
She was old.
She was old.
She was almost 90.
Okay.
What the fuck?
You and, saw her at the hospital in 20... So she went missing in about 2011. Wasn't heard from again. And then she is seen in the... You find her in a hospital, Roger, in 2015, and she's nearly 90 years old.
But how old was she when she went missing? 40.
Yeah, yeah, in that range. 30s, 40s.
And Roger was an agent with her when she was in her 40s
in the 2000s.
90s or 2000s. Yeah.
In the 2000s. Yes, so then, 2009.
And just because this was bothering me too, just when I never asked because it's so visual that I didn't really think about it. But when I saw Abigail at the party, when we were just talking to Abigail last episode, Abigail is still in her 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Abigail does not seem to have aged.
Aged. Okay.
Yeah. Very strange. But there is reason to believe that the, the Westover got caught up in all of this as well as part of a Delta Green operation and perhaps is living some sort of alternate timeline. This is something that all of you have seen kind of glimpses of, even in yourselves. We've seen Roger in World War II. We've seen, you know, Bobby in that scenario. We've seen Vicky with Christopher, without Christopher, on a flight with Roger, on a flight with Christopher, you know, that supposedly was at the same exact time to different places or whatever. So, yeah, there's a lot of strange...
Also, like Exeter said, he saw Abigail in Paris in 1995. Like, there's so many.
Right.
And going back in my notes.
Yes, to the end Sam, times, do it.
Way back when we first got this case and we went to her apartment, some of the information, like Abigail's credit card, for example, was seen used in Virginia. There was like weird stuff where it was like, how would she have gotten... to Virginia, like her credit card was seen used in Virginia, like very close to when she went missing, but we know for a fact that she went missing in New York. There's a bunch of weird stuff that I'm picking up on in my notes where I'm just like, the time, location, mm-hmm. like stuff just doesn't matter.
Yes. But if you add it all together, while it may not give you a clear answer to anything, what you do see are some major recurring themes, which are... the bookstore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paris.
Yeah.
Or at least France in World War II. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bobby met Private Lobelus, who had the radio, and he was in Paris. He was fighting in France in World War II when he suddenly vanished and was found and ended up in this place he doesn't know, a city called Yathil he'd never heard of. Something happened in Paris. But in 1890s Paris, Asa Darabondi's aunt was doing a play in Paris at that time and then moved back when it was shut down to Chicago to live with him for a while. And he told you this. He said she moved in with him. She started telling me all this stuff about the King in Yellow and blah, blah, blah. So there seems to be some sort of... perhaps Le Roi en Jaune, the King in Yellow, as it existed in France, was the first rendition that became the infection that infected the U.S., and it might have come through multiple paths. But the fact that both Barbas and Abigail end up visiting Paris in the 1800s just goes to show you how twisted the timelines became. 1895 in Paris. That's when Barbas saw Abigail there.
Well, that's
like 1895. Yeah. I wrote 1995.
I believe it's 1895.
1895. Oh my God.
Because in real life, the actual like King in Yellow book, it was a French author, right? Around that time.
I'm not sure, but maybe.
I believe.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So it's France and the U.S. It's all coming through there. And there's some more details that we haven't gotten into, but that's fine. That's fine. Your characters just don't know. So why go into it now? All right, let's get back.
Oh God.
Fade back up on the masquerade. Not many of the Delta Green agents, like Mosby, Dr. Lyra Westover, have made it this far, have made it to the party itself, but the four of you have. And what you do here will have echoes in eternity.
Eternity.
What do you do here? All right. We return to Roger, holding his bottle. This presence, Roger, suddenly gone. And you're standing there holding it. We hear the music of some stringed quartet playing. And everyone else is just continuing to party. And the anticipation, the electricity is rising as the king is supposedly going to arrive soon. Roger, you have reason to believe the king is already here. But your thoughts, what do you do next?
Very distracted because I'm just thinking about an epilogue. I'm going to try and focus.
In a way, this is the start of it.
This is the beginning of it. I think I'm just going to go with it and see what comes up. But I think in this moment, as he stares at this bottle, he is like taken back to a place where he's staring at like a bottle of whiskey that he's just emptied.
Yeah.
And you hear someone yelling at him, and he kind of like looks up from the bottle of whiskey, and it's Norma.
Ah.
And we hear like a baby crying somewhere in the room, and she's just like laying into him. She's like, "You got drunk again. What are you doing? We have a child now. Cal is gonna do." And he's just like totally out of. She's like, I'm leaving, and I'm taking him. I'm leaving, and I'm never coming back." And he's just like tries to reach for her and like falls out of the chair and drops the bottle, and it smashes on the floor. And he's like, now he's like all cut up. His hands are all cut up, and you just see her like grabbing a diaper bag and grabbing a bunch of shit and stopping with a child in her hand and looking down at him, this like pathetic drunk covered in blood. And she storms out of the house, and he comes back and he's staring at the bottle again. And like in that moment, so much of his life before starts coming back to him. His life before he was pulled into this alternate reality that is now like seven times removed from the original reality.
Yeah, for real.
And he looks over at Vicky. If he can find her, he's like looking for her.
You can see her. She's some distance away through several ranks of people, but you see her. And she's Vicky, what are you doing real quick?
Yeah, I'm going back. So she
Walked away from Lintz. That's my last memory of what we saw you doing.
She walked away from Lintz, and she wants to get away from this center stage area because she had run all the way up there to like get to Sam.
Yes.
So Vicky feels now she's having sort of like a second wind of her. She no longer feels like inept. She understands that Delta Green picked her for a reason. She has skills that have been useful. She's good at what she does. It's what she lives for. At least that was the case until she had Sam. And like Sam is what she lives for. And she knows that like no one else on her team is going to be able to get her and Sam safely out of here. She can't rely on anyone, not even Roger. So he told her that. He straight up told her that. He said, "I am for myself." And she's like, "Same, me too. I am for myself and I am for Sam." So she actually, I would like to go towards the tarot card reader.
Okay.
And find them.
Okay, so you start moving through the party. That's all the way by the entrance. So it's the complete opposite side of the party. So you're kind of pushing through people. And now Roger, you see this from some distance away. But you could get to where you see her moving with purpose back toward the front door where you guys originally came through.
So he sees her, and he knows that she's frantic, and he's like, He's kind of abandoned her. He said as much recently that he's like only in this for himself. But he's pulled back to that moment from the past. He sees her, sees that look on his on her face. And then he looks for Sam, for Murray. And is there like an empty glass somewhere?
Roll a luck roll.
Okay. Or like glassware of any kind that could be used, glasses, whatever. 66.
Yeah. As you're walking through, you don't see anybody holding a glass or using glass in this main open room, but perhaps in one of those side rooms, they might sit and drink and stuff like that. It seems like out here, people are just mingling and dancing. There's no drinks in their hands.
Okay. He's going to look for Murray. Do okay. I see him?
You look at Vicky. She's walking towards the door. You look at Murray. He's walking back towards Abigail by the stage. So they're both walking in opposite directions from each other.
All right. He wants to walk towards Murray.
Okay. So you're holding your bottle in one hand and you start moving towards Murray. In short order, you arrive and he is just getting back to Abigail.
Roger wants to uncork the bottle, grab Murray, and pour it down Murray's throat. What is...
What?
What? What?
Drink my essence, boy. Drink it. Oh,
no. Do you want to know what's going on through his head? Or do you want to just resolve the action?
In his mind, he feels like a failure of a man, a failure of a husband, a failure of a father that now has crossed and spanned multiple universes. And he feels like if there is a chance for escape, which is what I think the bottle said, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the best thing he can do for Vicky, for himself, for anyone, is to help Murray escape, is to save Murray. Because he knows that Vicky, if she had a choice and could only save one person in this entire situation, it would be him. So it's like that's what he thinks he's doing. He thinks he's saving Murray for Vicky and for the man that he wishes he was. But he's not giving Murray a choice. He's just going to
jam it down his throat.
Right in front of Abigail, too. Then.
Sure. Okay. The problem here is that in the instant that you open the bottle that you fully intend to give to Murray, the problem is that you, Roger, opened the bottle, regardless of your intentions. You open this bottle and everything around you seems to shudder and shift into multiple fractured realities at once. Let's start with a sanity roll.
Oh my God.
It's like, let's start with a sanity roll.
And see what happens.
Let's start with a sanity
check. Might not matter.
Yeah.
23 under a lot.
Under. Wow. 23 under relatively high sanity. Okay. So the, hold on a second. Let me change this up here for a second. So the second you open this up with the intention to pass it on, you immediately take 7 points of sanity damage. And this. Let me find this. This intense the best way to describe it is these visions. Your life flashing before your eyes, except it's lives flashing before your eyes.
Yeah.
It is an entire lifetime in the 20s and 30s, and then your service in the war in the 40s. It's being a grandfather and having grandchildren and looking over at your wife and not even recognizing her. It's being in New York. What do you call it? Long Island. Sorry, it's being in Long Island in 2019 and investigating a murder. It's being in Long Island in 2019 and sitting in a high school conference room smoking a cigarette and berating a child. Being there at the birth with the birth of Cal, it's you at the same time. Whomp, it switches this perspective shifts, and it's the 1800s, and you're holding a little girl. You see yourself sitting in a chair. A masked man in this black mask stands across from you, and through the fibers of a linen mask cover that's been put over your face, you see a gun being raised into your face, and then. Bang! Fired as blackness goes over it. You see all of these different elements, and as you see flashes of Murray with Vicky, with Christopher, with graduations and t-ball games and baseball games and each different rendition of his life, you see the fabric, the answer to all of it and how it all came together and how he was destined for destruction by ever being connected to you at all. And how Vicky's connection to him, his one lifeline, is something that occurred due to the machinations of the King in Yellow. That all of this has been planned. That everything that you do has nothing to do with the choices that you make. And particularly, that he is incapable of escaping from this place with your bottle. That only those with their own bottle can properly escape this place. And the realization floods into you as you grab him, you reach over, you start to try to pour it, and then we just see you shaking, Abigail standing across from you with a smile, a small smirk on her face, and you're almost frozen in this shuddering moment of realization that the only way that you can get him out of here is either by Vicky finding a way or by you finding a bottle in some sort of infinitesimal, multidimensional space that is outside of time, which is, you can barely even wrap your mind around it. You take 7 points of sanity damage. Let's turn to Vicky. Vicky, you are, Roger's frozen in time for a second. You have been moving through the party toward this tarot card reader, and you see she is this woman, older woman dressed in a black dress with like a black veil over her eyes, and she's passing these tarot cards out to people that are coming up to get their readings, and there seems to be a line of like four or five people there. What do you do?
I cut in front of them. Are you freaking kidding me? I don't have fucking time for this. I'm from New York. I have a reservation. I'm standing here, not in line. Excuse me.
Cut in line.
I just walk to the front of the table. Yeah, I just walk up.
You walk up to the front of the table. Okay, so she is, giving a reading at the moment, and she stops, looks up at you, and freezes. She sits still for a moment, and she just simply turns to the person across from her and says, "I'm so sorry. We'll have to continue this later." Person's like, "What? But we're just in the middle of it." She says, "Not now. You'll need to go." And she starts gathering up the cards. And this person, this woman in a huff, gets up from the table in her big green dress and starts to move away from the table. She looks across at you, nods, and says, "You're early.
I need a reading, and I need it now, and I need to know what I am supposed to do."
"What you're supposed to do?" She sits down across from
you. "I didn't believe in this witchy woo-woo stuff in the 90s, and everybody was into it, and I wasn't into it, and I don't have another choice. This is it. This is all I have. So if you could just give me the psychic, the answer, the whatever, the meaning of life or whatever."
"I'm afraid it doesn't work that way, dear. I put the cards out and I tell you what's possible. But only you can decide how this will end." She starts pulling out cards, laying them out in front of you, and says,
Yes. It's as I suspected. You're early. You have unfinished business. Yes? Something you have not yet done.
My son is here, and I can't leave the party until I get him.
Of course he is. And she points to a card that's just the bear. It's like this bear. She just refers to the card and says, he's right here.
The bear? What does that mean?
Yes. Your son, you wish to protect him, yes?
Yeah.
And what do you need to do to protect him?
To get him out of here, to take him with me home.
Ah. And how will you escape?
I don't know. That's why I came over here.
She's like reviewing over the overlay of cards. She says,
you're running out of time. You must finish before you return.
I understand what that fucking means. And she grabs this woman's hands. Do you know the bottles? Is it the bottles? I have this one. And she pulls out J.C. Lince's. I don't understand, though. Am I supposed to give it to him?
You have not given it to him.
No.
Where did you find it?
In the labyrinth, in the whisper room.
Well, I suggest giving it to him before the king arrives.
I don't understand.
Then you could see me. And I could help you.
You can't.
You're holding her hand, but she's being very vague, mysterious, this veil over her eyes.
And then she looks closer at her. I don't recognize her, right?
You do not recognize her. Okay. No.
Do you know Abigail?
Yes. She is a new favorite of the royal family.
And she like looks up and you see the royal table, you know, it sits up above where everybody's sitting. She looks up at the table and back to you.
It is rumored that she'll be marrying soon.
No. Okay, so I give him the bottle and I come back to you, okay? And then you get me and Sam out.
And she just smiles.
Oh, fuckers. You're all absolute.
Fuck you.
Fuckers. And Vicky lets go of her hands. Don't fuck with me. Okay. And then Vicky walks away to go find J.C. Lintz again. God, I feel insane.
Okay. Let's go to Neil, do you have any intentions other than waiting for the king?
I was thinking about this morning. Sort of the common through line with Neil's personality with surgery, being a surgeon and being a film director. And the commonality there is ego. It's like control, like crafting your own reality. Control over life and death or control over a universe. And I was thinking about this too. I actually thought about this a little last week, but hadn't really kind of coalesced my thoughts. Do you guys know the movie Malice? Do you remember this movie?
I think so. Was it Alec Baldwin?
Yeah, Alec Baldwin movie.
Vaguely, yeah. He was a doctor.
He's a doctor. It's like that's an Aaron Sorkin script, and he's like giving a deposition, and he's asked whether he has a God complex. And I'm just going to like do this quote.
I have an MD from Harvard. I'm board certified in cardiothoracic medicine and trauma surgery. I've been awarded citations from 7 different medical boards in New England, and I'm never, ever sick at sea. So, I ask you, when someone goes into that chapel and they fall on their knees and they pray to God that their wife doesn't miscarry, or that their daughter doesn't bleed to death, or that their mother doesn't suffer acute neural trauma from post-operative shock, who do you think they're praying to? Now go ahead and read your Bible, Dennis, and you go to your church, and with any luck, you might win the annual raffle. But if you're looking for God, he was in operating room number 2 on November 17th, and he doesn't like to be second-guessed. You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God. And that's Neil.
That's amazing.
That's good.
So he has every intention, whether through obliviousness or like overconfidence in his own ability and might, or he knows something deep down that is actually true. He intends to wait for the king in yellow and usurp the throne and take it for himself.
Oh my God.
Okay. Okay. Then why don't I wrestle with that for a minute and we'll take a break. And we'll come right back.
Oh my God.
Throw me some curveballs. I love it. We'll be back in a second. We're back and ready to continue the masquerade. Bobby, I would go to you, but I'm not going to. I've got my reasons.
Okay.
If we remember from last time, Bobby was standing at the right side of the throne, awaiting the arrival of the king as well. Saw himself. We talked about this briefly. And you are still there waiting. I mean, do you want to do anything right in this moment, or are you still in Neil's sort of camp, okay, waiting to determine what you want to do until after the king arrives?
I think he's still there. He's still in the mindset of becoming the colonel, but there's a part of him that is doubting. There's a small part of him that as he sits there waiting, is doubting. It's like, am I the colonel? I am the colonel. No, I am the colonel. And he's just kind of going through that in his mind, but he's still just keeping that outer, like, rigid stance, like, as if okay. He was a man-at-arms.
Love it. A very kind of, like, it's an identity disorder, right?
Yes.
If you were back on Earth and all this was done, and we would say, what mental disorders have you come away with? You're having an identity disorder, truly, right now. You don't know who you really are. You believe you are as much the colonel as you are Bobby.
Exactly.
It's a very, very strange position to be in. Okay, Vicky is hustling through, and Roger, frozen in time for this moment, outside of space and time, is rocketing in some way through lives and existences. He's seeing the Matrix as he never has before. Roger is seeing all of the lives before, all of the lives yet to come, all of the different versions of himself, and perhaps an answer in his own mind that we can never fully understand. The answer to a couple questions, potentially, such as, how did you become a member of Delta Green? You know, like, is that something that you see in this moment? Because you never seem to really know. Also,
I thought about that today, actually.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I thought about how it happened in case that came up.
Right. Well, if you have an answer, you could tell us it in this moment as these flashes of lives that you never knew or didn't connect with or didn't remember are flashing through. Do you want to share or do you want to hold on to it for now?
I'll share it because it's not fully formed, but I had this thought that he was sent on a mission during during Desert Storm, and was put in charge of a small unit that had to go infiltrate this bunker or something, and very quickly he gets this, you know, with his hyper awareness, even though he was younger, he gets this sense that something isn't right and tries to pull everybody out of there and it was like a setup of some sort, and everyone in his platoon dies, but somehow he gets out. And once he realizes that that immediate danger is over, he presses forward into the place where they were supposed to go and witnesses this otherworldly being that's like in a cage somewhere, but the cage is made of like electromagnetic pulses. It's not a real cage, and he like sees through the veil for the first time. And that's just the only thing that we see.
Yeah, so we see this brief image of Roger in front of this cage with some entity inside of it. We start to see, like, Roger has seen the unnatural long before. And you're torn in and out of these realities. A few things, as I said, like, come to you so clearly. One, Sam cannot escape with your bottle. It doesn't work that way. He has to have his own bottle in order to escape through this path. You are being ripped from this place. You're being torn away, and you are being banished. You are being dismissed. You are being exiled from court, essentially, and it starts to make sense to you. All of these things, none of them make sense, but it starts to come to an answer. Maybe you almost hear a voice in your head that just says, the play exists to make itself, and in doing so, it makes the world. And then you know the king chose you to get your bottle because you had to leave. He needed you out of here to complete his plans. So you are on the road to safety, but your friends, your allies, have been left vulnerable because you were too dangerous to leave in the court. So handing you your bottle was the thing he needed to get you out of there. But it's too late. You're being pulled and stripped away. You can see Sam Murray. Maybe for a moment you're back in the ballroom, and you're being pulled through the crowd as you know, through some, like, if this was a movie, like bad special effects, right? Like not trying to look good special effects, where like your character is on like wheels or something, and you're just like, oh, like being weirdly pulled back away from him, and you're being sucked out of court and away from everything and shunted into another reality. And I'm going to leave you with this. You are being exiled from Carcosa, and you are being returned to Earth. In this moment, you passed your sanity check. What this is going to allow you to do is land in any life you want, in any time you want. And you can make that choice. But sit with that for a moment as we return to Vicky, who gets up from the tarot card table, starts moving across the masquerade, and has no idea at this point that Roger is gone. Has vanished from the room.
God damn, I don't even notice that he's gone.
Well, it's all the way across the entire ballroom. Like, he was with Sam and Abigail all the way at the back, and Abigail was just smiling because she knew. She was like, his last noble attempt to save his son was very noble, but now he's not a problem.
Okay, can I
one
do...
One less piece on the chessboard that she needs to move.
Can I do a human check on that fucking tarot card reader? Was she giving me the same shit-eating grin that Abigail was giving me?
Human, the veil. Yeah, I'd say it's a very similar shit-eating grin. And the shit-eating grin is because they seem to both know what you desire. And they both seem to know that in order for you to get what you desire, you have to do something you don't want to do. That's the source of the shit-eating grin. For whatever reason, which they don't really know, they can't really wrap their head around, you seem resistant to give J.C. Lentz his bottle, but they both know that in order for you to get what you want, you have to do that. At least, that's the solution as it's been presented to you.
Yeah. Okay. I head toward J.C. Lentz.
You head toward J.C. Lentz. Easy enough to find him. Raven mask wearing He's wearing a suit, a not particularly expensive suit, like I said, holding a big briefcase and just sort of like looking around the party. As he sees you coming up to him, he says, hey, you. You were the one. What was your mask again?
Oh, it's like a porcelain doll.
Right. He sees you in the porcelain doll mask with the blue, like, Baroque Renaissance-y gown, you know, and he's just like, you were the one that was talking about my bottle, and I can't get it out of my head now. You seem to say it was here or something. Is it here or not? I gotta know, and I don't have a lot of time. And he's like, kind of like looking side to side, but you can't really see his eyes. They're behind this raven mask.
Yeah.
As he's looking around.
Yeah. I know who has it.
Who? Where? You, where are they?
You know Abby?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got it.
She doesn't have it. If she had it, she told me she couldn't get it.
Yeah, she lied. She's been lying to all of us.
All right.
I'll go with you. We can go talk to her together.
Why she wouldn't give it to me?
Yeah, I don't know either. I think she's fucking crazy.
He says, "All right."
She's a fucking bitch.
Whoa. He says, wow, you got a mouth on you.
Yeah, welcome to 2015. You can say shit like that.
2015?
Yeah, you heard me. You want to go talk to her? Let's go together. I got some choice words that I would like to say to her in front of my son.
All right.
Come here. And she grabs his arm in the way that like a cop does when they escort you out of somewhere. She grabs his arm and she would like to march up. To
Jeez,
Abigail.
All right, ease up. You're grabbing me like you're the fuzz or something.
That's funny. That's a funny joke you just said. Come on.
You pull him fuzz. Through this party. You're wading through.
What are you, a Pinkerton?
You're wading Jesus, through this. You're wading Jesus. Through this mass of people, and you see Abigail and Sam, and you just catch the whisper. Right at the edge of your vision of her whispering to Sam and just saying, it won't be long now. Any minute he's coming and we can be here forever.
You fucking bitch.
You just hear this right at the edge of your vision as you come through the crowd. And then she sees you and says, did you get it? To J.C. Lentz. No, she says you have my bottle. She says, she has your bottle. She's supposed to give it to you. You still haven't given him the bottle? And she looks at Sam, like kind of lovingly, and then back to you.
I need to talk to my son. I thought we could all talk together. Sam, can you come here for a second?
What?
Come here Mom? Right now, Samuel.
No. Whatever you can say to me, you can say in front of Ed.
Oh, shit.
Samuel Murray Ricci.
Once the king blesses our union, we will be married. And
Samuel,
he seems a little unsure of himself.
Samuel, you never even had a fucking communion. Why do you care about all of this hoity-toity shit? I thought I raised you better than this.
I don't understand why you're yelling at me.
Come
why
here.
Why are
I
you
just...
so unhappy?
Fine, I'll come up there. And Vicky would like
well,
to...
He's just standing right in front
oh,
of me.
Oh, Vicky. Okay, so then Vicky reaches in... Where did I keep the bottle? My bosom. Vicky reaches into her bosom and puts the bottle in Samuel's hands. And then she wants to take his hands and pull open the bottle with his hands. Just like put it in his hands and open it like with his hands.
All right. All right. Well, I mean, he's going to resist you pulling his hands
okay.
to start. Yep. So, like, you go to pull his hands, and he says, what are you doing? J.C. Lentz says, his eyes go wide, and he lunges for the bottle.
I'd like to do, like, an unarmed combat or something to just, like, grab
Hell
Sam.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. All right. Well, there's three sort of combatants going on here. There's okay. Sam trying to resist you, J.C. Lentz trying to get his bottle, and you trying to get Sam. So, like, I don't really know how J.C. Lentz is going to factor into this. But let's do it. Here we go. So first thing that happens is, you pull out the bottle. J.C. Lentz immediately sees his name on it and says,
covering it. cover.
Hey, that's mine!
And he goes to grab it. So
I would like to elbow JC Lintz. Then, if he's the first to move, I'm going to elbow him squarely in the nose.
Okay, give me an opposed roll.
Okay, so I'm doing unarmed combat.
Unarmed combat, yeah. Yep. Opposed unarmed combat roll.
Come on. Yes, you bitch. 13 under 50.
13 under 50. I rolled a 67, which is too high. And he just, bam! He takes one in like the nose of his raven mask. It kind of goes cockeyed for a second. And he stumbles back. And you have a moment to kind of grab at Sam.
He pulls his hands away.
So, I mean, I don't...
Can I do an opposed?
I don't really know what you're trying to do here. This doesn't make any sense to me. You're going to grab a man's hand and make him open a bottle?
I'm shoving the bottle into his hand, you know, like I'm shoving it into his hand, forcing him to take it. And even though he's resisting, obviously.
Can I just say something? It is so obviously clear. You just got to give JC Litz the bottle.
And you have found a way to do 100 other things. It's never been more clear. You just got to give him the bottle.
Abigail wants me. As soon as Joe made Abigail part of Sam's thing, I'm not doing anything she says.
That whore is not getting my boy.
Well, I mean, that's what I don't really understand. Maybe perhaps you're missing that. It's like what she said is the only way he can go with you is if you give JC Lentz his bottle.
I just don't trust.
If you don't, we're staying together forever. And Sam doesn't know about the bottle. He doesn't know. That was all private conversation. He thinks he's staying with her forever. She on the side told you, you just got to do this one thing for me, and then I'll let him go.
All right, so you know what? In this moment then, if you're telling me...
You don't have to trust her. I'm just clarifying her intentions were.
If you're telling me that Sam's like fully resisting, you know, she tries to give him this bottle.
Yeah, he's like, what are you doing? And so pulling his hands away, JC Lintz is like, motherfucker!
Vicky just feels out of control. Like, she can't make her son do, you know, what she wants him to do. And, fine.
Come on, give it to me!
She just shoves it into JC Lintz's hand. She elbows him again.
Just for good measure.
One more pop.
She elbows him and then does the thing where you like punch backwards. So she hits him two times. Whack.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, she says, you're welcome.
God, just amazing.
Just beat him up and they just handle the bottle anyway.
Just kicking him in the gut while he's down, hunched over. Oh, please stop.
You guys made me feel stupid. Now I'm giving him this fucking bottle.
It's just so amazing. Like, we're just trying to wrap up this 3-year story. And Troy's just like, it's so obvious. You just have to do this. And you are doing everything
so
in your power.
Make you feel like you have another choice. No. And you just keep taking
it. No, you do. Yeah, you do have another choice, but it does seem like you don't have another choice if you want to get out of here. You could just not get out of here. You could not give Abigail the satisfaction, but then you wouldn't get out of here. That seems to be the choice.
This is me in an open world video game trying to like jump across something that's the end of the map.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I'm pretty sure if I could get across.
I think I can get there.
This is a puzzle. It's not a puzzle. I just have to give JC Lentz the bottle, apparently. All right, I give him the bottle, and Vicky is also exasperated. She's just like, fine.
He takes it. Oh, I can't even believe. Thank you so much. And he sets down this big briefcase. Boom, and it's on like the dais, right? Mm-hmm. Where like the royal family is sitting, kind of up there. He just sets it on the corner of this table that's jutting out by where you guys are. He just sets it down, and with a shaking hand, just sort of like uncorks the bottle. And you don't notice anything in particular, but you see this kind of like just rapturous smile come over his face, this shuddering joy of like, oh. And he opens his eyes and his eyes go up to the sky and he says, That's it. And it's kind of in the way Roger was frozen in time. J.C. Lentz is seeing things you don't know, you don't understand. He's and he's putting together all these pieces. He's understanding what needs to happen, what needs to go. And he reaches out and he grabs you by the shoulder and his eyes are wide. And he doesn't squeeze too hard. He just grabs you and he just says, I know it now. I know the story I need to write. I know. And he turns and just drops the bottle to the floor and it just ting, 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 ting. Doesn't break, doesn't shatter. Very thick glass. Just like ting, ting, tinks down to the floor and he opens up the briefcase and this thick briefcase opens and you see there's nothing inside of it but a typewriter. Just a big, chunky travel typewriter.
It's not Marcel Wallace's soul.
It's not yeah, Marcel Wallace's
the glow.
Soul. Yeah. Clicks it open.
We good.
I could have sworn it was Marcel Wallace. That was good.
He opens it up and pulls out from the top layer pocket sheaf of paper and scrolls it in and just starts clack, clack, clacking away and just starts talking to himself. Along the shore, the cloud waves break. The twin suns sink behind the lake. The shadows lengthen in Carcosa. He's writing and you get the realization that giving J.C. Lentz his bottle has given birth to the play. The King in Yellow.
You fuckers!
It could not have reached Earth if you did not give J.C. Lentz.
Is he the author?
He is the author.
Oh, what? Wow. Are you fucking kidding me?
Can you give me a quick sanity check?
I hate all of you. I knew it. I fucking knew it. And you bullied me. And you fucking bullied me.
And you bullied me?
You should never have listened to us.
18 under 34. I'm not crazy.
Wow.
I knew it. I fucking knew it.
Hey, Sid, wow. I got to tell you, that's a huge sanity save.
Oh.
A huge sanity save.
Thank God.
Oh, wow.
You take 6 points of sanity damage on a success.
Wow. I'm a success.
But wow. You maintain, you should see what the failure roll is.
Oh my God.
You maintain, you realize that you have given birth to the play, The King in Yellow, and that you had to do it if you and Sam were going to escape. But now, keeping your wits about you, you know that you have a chance, and maybe it's with the tarot card reader. Maybe that's the way out, but you have done this thing and you see him typing along and Abigail just smiling at you, that same shit-eating smile. And she just says, you've done perfectly. And she walks away. And Sam's like, Abby? Abby? And he starts to walk toward her and she's just ignoring him and just walking away. What do you do?
I grab Sam.
Grabs him. What are you doing?
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
What was that? Who is that? Point to J.C. Lentz.
I did it for you. We have to go. Sam, I'm so sorry.
Why do we have to go now?
I love you so much.
But the king is coming.
I tried to do everything right. I shouldn't have.
He's looking around and he can't see Abigail anywhere. Where did she go?
We gotta go. Come on, Sam. Come on, walk with me.
He's walking with you, but he's still looking. He's still looking around.
And she's going to pull him back towards the tarot card reader.
Pull him back toward the tarot card reader.
And she's also looking. I mean, I assume I see Bobby and I see Neil.
You see Neil, and Neil is standing in front of the throne looking up at it. A work of art behind it. Which we don't see in this particular camera shot, but he's just sort of staring up at it, and there's a smile on Neil's face that you might be able to barely see underneath his... What mask was that?
Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster.
And do I see Bobby?
Yes, you see Bobby, and he's standing at attention up against the table, looking out into the crowd.
She said, I mean, as she's pulling Sam away from this whole dais area, she says, makeshift! Murnau! I'm going. I'm leaving. Makeshift! Murnau!
Neil doesn't respond. Does nope. Bobby, does the colonel say anything?
The colonel hears this, and then Bobby's also like, wait, makeshift, is that me?
And then she yells, Bobby!
And he looks towards where Vicky is yelling, and it's like he's trying to make out who she is. It's like she looks familiar, but like he can't really place the face. And then behind him, he sees the Bobby in his witch doctor outfit staring right back at him, just stone cold staring at him. And he stops looking at Vicky and just starts looking at the witch doctor, Bobby, like just locked eyes, catatonic almost. And that's it. He's not moving. He's not doing anything.
He's just here. He's outside. You hear people whispering. The king is right outside the door.
Vicky is backing up. I mean, as she was yelling that, she was like pulling Sam, talking behind her, trying just to let them know.
Abby! Abigail!
Sam, she's not. And she just pushes Sam in front of her to kind of clear the crowd as she steers him towards the tarot card reader.
Okay, you bring him toward the tarot card reader, and the music sort of like slows to a stop. You reach the tarot card reader, and she's telling like a person that's sitting in front of you, like, I'm sorry, it's time. The king is arriving. We cannot continue. And this man gets up, walks away in anticipation, in giddy anticipation for the arrival of the king. And you come up to her. What do you say?
I did it. It's done.
It's done. Well, we don't have much time now. Sit quickly.
And she sits down. She pulls Sam down.
There's another chair for Sam to sit down as well. The two of you sit down, and she begins shuffling the cards, and she is looking around, and she is feeling like you get this sense of panic in her a little bit, like she's realizing that the time is running out, and she starts shuffling. She starts to deal a card, and she kind of like thinks better of it. She puts it back into the deck and says, there's no time. You have to go now. And she holds up the full deck in front of you vertically, holding the entire thing into her hand, and then she does like a magician squeeze with the deck, and it just all of the cards rattle out at you into your face, and you are suddenly buffeted with this blackness and this darkness. You see yourself behind the stage in the underground, deep underground, the hospital where the play was happening. You see this clown running away from you, chasing after Bobby, and you're there, standing there with Sam. He's there with you, and the clown doesn't seem to be paying attention to you. It's running away, and then suddenly you're standing there with Sam. You're holding his hand, and the two of you are just running through Washington Square Park, and the clown is running after you. It's all this like distorted, but the clown almost looks almost two dimensional, like it's on a card, like it's like one of the tarot cards, and you're just like totally like freaked out, and in an abundance of overwhelming like fear and terror as to what is happening to you. Give me a sanity roll.
Oh my god.
It's the fucking clown again.
It's the fucking clown.
It's the fucking clown.
It's always the fucking clown, man.
Yeah, I mean, no. 36 over 28. It's like impossible to roll under.
Yeah.
I rolled incredibly low.
Oh my god.
8 points of sanity damage.
Jeez.
Incredibly low. Lucky son of a bitch.
Like a D100.
And you are... the 8 sanity damage is you losing consciousness and you black out.
Oh my god.
How much Shannon do you have left?
Yeah, like she's got like 12 sandwiches.
It's like tripping. Like she just trips and like the ground doesn't meet her where she's at. She should have hit the ground and she doesn't. And then she's just in blackness, but it feels like her eyes are open. She feels conscious, but she is unconscious.
And we see Vicky and Sam are gone from the hall, from the court, from the masquerade. At that moment, the doors fling open wide. The music has stopped, and there is a gasp throughout the crowd as the much-anticipated arrival has come. Stepping up and into the entrance is the figure of a man who seems strangely tall and also rather well-built, pretty wide, wearing this flowing yellow robe and a yellow mask. Porcelain mask over the face. There's a crown upon his head, but even as you look at him, it starts to hurt your eyes, Bobby, and you kind of have to look away. Now you are sort of feeling his presence moving toward you peripherally, but you have a hard time looking straight at him. Neil, give me a POW times five roll. Bobby, give me a POW times five roll.
Oh,
it's walking through this creature, whatever this thing is. It feels inhuman, and it is making its way into the ballroom, gasping. Some people are screaming. Some people seem to be fainting. There's all kinds of commotion happening near the door. Bobby, POW times five.
53 under 55.
53 under 55. Amazing. And Neil?
44 under 60.
Critical success. Ooh. Neil, you look across and you are able to, after a brief moment, you look back and you can see without looking away the king almost as an equal. Bobby, you are aware enough with your power roll to see the king approaching. You're not looking directly at him. That's a little bit too hard for you. But you see the king approaching Bobby in the witch doctor costume. Bobby turns and seems stunned and transfixed by the king in the witch doctor costume, frozen in place, his arms defenseless beside him, and the king settles and stops right in front of him. The king reaches up to his mask. The king grabs his mask. The king begins to remove his mask while looking at Bobby. Do you do anything in this moment, or are you witnessing? Just witnessing. Stunned.
He's stunned. He's frozen. He's just
witnessing.
Like, he's like, that's my king.
The mask pulls away. You can't see what Bobby is seeing.
Right.
And you hear this inhuman scream from Bobby that just gutturally comes out of somewhere that you don't understand, and he shudders and just is shattered into light and nothingness in one moment, is consumed and vanishes, and the king replaces his mask. You have no doubt that you are the colonel. There is no Bobby. Bobby is dead. This figure moves closer, continues to move toward Bobby, or toward you, I should say, toward the colonel.
Oh, God.
He's moving toward you, and you're having trouble looking at him. You're kind of looking down at his feet as the presence, the aura is so intense that it feels impossible to look at. And he reaches for his mask. This is right next to you, Neil, but you're looking at him and you're like, I'm ready, whenever you want. Bobby, he pulls the mask away. And in that moment,
you see the true king, the true face of the king in yellow. Give me a sanity check.
My eyes burn out like fucking Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I was gonna say this sounds so similar to when Sid and I saw Harrison Ford.
Yes, this is exactly what happened.
The guy just dematerialized in the light right there in the room.
That's how I felt.
This is insane.
Skid turned to dust, and I had to gather him up and take him home.
Thank you for that again, Sid. By the way,
I got a 37 over. Goddamn, 14. Jesus,
37 over 14.
Yeah.
Okay. I normally roll the sanity damage. That's sort of that's our routine here. This one's a little too big, though, so I'm going to have you roll it.
Oh, God.
At the moment that you see and understand the true face of the king in yellow, you take D100 sanity damage. Now, with 14 sanity, you could survive this.
Oh,
I could.
You could.
I could. It's a thing that could happen. It's in the realm of possibility.
It's possible. Now I can tell you. Probable.
I can tell you the vague results of these outcomes are: if you take more than 14 points of sanity loss, you will be completely destroyed.
Yes.
As an entity, if you survive this test from the King in Yellow, you will survive and have some agency over how your life plays out from here. But it is, of course, an extremely intense experience. So take D100 sanity damage. Roll the D100 and tell me how many it is.
Come
here on. It is. The end of all things for come the monster.
On. Come on. Yay. Oh, crack die. Crack die. It fell out of the. It fell out of the thing. I got to roll again. I got to roll again.
Do it.
All right.
Roll again.
All right.
Dear God. Come on. What the? I got a 12. I'm not shitting you.
Get out of here.
I got a fucking 12. I can't fucking believe it. I'm looking at this right now, and I'm not fucking. I can't.
I can't wow. even believe that shit.
Holy shit.
With 14 sanity, you survived a D100 tick wow. of sanity.
By two. By two.
By two. By two.
Are you kidding me? That's insane.
Wow.
Oh, God.
You really are strong of mind.
This is the greatest day of my life.
What happens when you have two sanity?
You know,
well, when you have two God. Sanity, maybe it's time to call BetterHelp. BetterHelp provides yeah. services, people.
Yeah, it's time for an ad read. Oh, my God. So, yeah, I got two okay. sanity points.
This is tough. This is a tough position for me to be in. I do want to give you some agency, but the representative, but what has happened to you is so intense. So I'll give you a choice, and you can think about it. We don't have to go to you right away.
Okay.
You can, in this moment, that the mask, that you see the face, you can leave this plane and return to Earth if you want. However, there will be severe repercussions for the sanity that you have lost and the things that you have experienced. So severe that you may be close to not able to choose that much about your future.
Right.
If you choose to never return and stay here, you can have more agency as you willingly give yourself over. Think about it. There's good and bad on both sides. And then finally, the king turns to regard Neil. What an absolute fucking stud this guy is. Comes up to Neil, and there's a moment where there's an acknowledgement of something, like a brief nod. And then the same thing, the mask being removed. Only this time, the mask is being removed, and he begins to place the mask on your face. He reaches over, and as the mask is hovering just close to your skin, your brain is suddenly inundated with cosmic knowledge beyond comprehension. So this is not different flashes of lifelines. This is not things you could be. This is the understanding that Neil is nothing.
Neil is nothing compared to this knowledge, and all of humanity is but a spark and a blip and nothing, right? It's such an unbelievable amount of understanding and knowledge. So give me a sanity roll.
Okay. This is funny. This happens in, I think, Restaurant at the End of the Universe, and one of the Hitchhiker's guidebooks.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the ultimate torture chamber. Like, they put people in this thing and it like exposes like the totality of the universe to them in one instant. Oh. And like the crushing realization of how insignificant they are destroys anyone who's in it, like, mentally. And they, it's so funny because they try to put Zaphod Beeblebrox in there, but he happens to be in an alternate dimension where the entire universe is built around him.
Oh,
so
my
he comes
God.
Out, he's like, that's awesome. That's great.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
So funny. So funny.
That's great.
Okay.
All right. So give me a sanity roll. Let's see what you get here.
38 over 20.
You take D100 points of sanity damage.
Oh, man.
And you're gonna roll it over 20. You said you got 20.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, God. Am I a Zaphod or am I an Arthur Dent? Okay. 67.
67 points of sanity damage. This understanding fuses with you completely, and the mask fuses to your face. We see the mask fuse onto your face, and the king, now maskless, turns to the crowd. The crowd all begins to scream and wallow and collapse and fall before you, and yet you, Neil, seem fine. This is an unbelievably overwhelming amount of knowledge, but you feel as if you belong standing here looking down at all these people that are collapsing, and as they're screaming, and as they're fading, and as they're falling, let's cut away to Vicky. Vicky, from darkness, your eyes blink open. And you're laying on a wooden floor, wooden paneled floor. Dusty, little old, little dirty. And you see tarot cards all around you on the floor. Some face up, some face down, look like they were spilled about you. As you come to, your first instincts are that you're in a basement of some kind. There's cleaning supplies and racks of like toilet paper and stuff. It's like a mops and buckets and stuff like that, a ladder. And you see laying next to you is Sam. On this basement floor, you feel like you hear the vague sense of car horns honking in the distance.
She's gonna scuttle over to Sam. Sam, baby. Sam.
Mom?
Oh, fuck. She pulls him in. Tight. He's the same age. Like, we're the same age.
Mm-hmm. You're the same age.
He's a 75-year-old man.
He's so old! Kisses him on the head. Holds him. Are you okay?
Where are we?
Are you all right? Are you cut? Are you bleeding?
I think I'm fine. Where are we? How did we get here?
I don't know. Hold on, stand up.
And you see a set of stairs, like, going up. That's what another thing makes you think you're in a basement.
Come on, follow me. And I'll walk up the stairs with Sam holding his hand.
You go walking up some stairs, and at the top is an old wooden door with an old iron doorknob. A bronze doorknob that's all faded and dark. You squeak it and open the door, and the squeaky door opens up, and you just see shelves and shelves of books. A wood paneled floor. And what looks to be, as you come around and peek, a small bookstore. Like a used bookstore. You don't see anybody in it. You don't see anybody at the front counter. But you hear someone in the back. Like, there's like an office. And you just hear someone talking, like a man's voice. But outside the doors, You see glass panel doors with books sort of faded, the word faded books on the painted on the glass. You just see New York City. People just walking by. It looks like cars driving. Vroom, vroom. It looks like modern New York City.
Oh my God. Okay. Okay. I think we can go. I think we could just go.
Sam, where are we?
Just go.
Go where?
We'll go to your dad's. We'll go to Christopher's.
And you start to walk out?
Yeah, a part of me wants to check who's in that fucking room, but I don't want to. I don't want to.
It's us looking in that closet into the fucking bookstore from before, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
That's insane.
I think in this moment she wants to get outside. She wants to breathe air.
You walk to the door.
Bling bling.
A bell rings as you open it up. And you slip out to the sidewalk. We see the sun hitting your face. All the cars, all the people on the street, everything looks like it's 2015. Looks like it's modern day. And we'll come back to you. This is the end of Vicky's trail on the King in Yellow, but we'll come back to you for an epilogue here. But you've made it, but you are mentally fucked up. You have multiple disorders. You have passed multiple breaking points in Cargos that you did not feel. You also feel an unbelievable pain in your shoulder as this gunshot pain returns. A broken bone, none of which seem to bother you in the least or even exist in this other existence. It all comes crashing back. And in that moment, though, you feel free, potentially. Potentially. Let's go back to Bobby. It was your choice. Do you return to Earth, or do you stay at the right hand of the king?
So I think in Bobby's mind, I mean, at this point, he's not Bobby. He saw Bobby get destroyed,
mm-hmm.
and he's completely embracing it. He is now the colonel. And he will stay where he thinks he needs to be, which is at the right hand of power. And he's,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then let's go to Roger. Roger had the most sanity of anybody, bizarrely, and could return to any place or time he wanted. He has fully escaped, it seems, from the orbit of the King in Yellow. And Troy, you have your own choice to tell the end of Roger's story in Impossible Landscapes here.
I've had a lot of time to think about it. Still not 100% sure here, but
I don't know what I would do with that choice. Any place, any time, any lifeline.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm glad it's not me.
That's awesome.
I would just be like, I want to be John Elway. And I would just be done.
Awesome. Well, you still have to be Roger.
John Elway is pride. It is pride.
It's also hard. It's like, there's like this meta too of like my role in the company too, and knowing like how important Roger is to the network. Like I can't not think about that as well. So here's where I'm going to go with this. I think we'll see like a foot step out of bed, and it's an older looking foot. It's very slow. It's like gingerly coming down, and then another foot comes down. You can tell that whoever this person is moving very slowly, very deliberately. And you know, from the feet, maybe we pan up the legs, and you can tell from the body of this person that they might have once been like large, but now they've kind of like collapsed into themselves a little bit. It's an old man. His face is weathered and wrinkled. He has very little hair on his head, just some like liver spots, like faint liver spots on his scalp. And his eyes are just, you know, kind of glazed over, and maybe he's missing a couple teeth. And he scratches himself, and
gets up and starts walking across this small apartment. And maybe as he does, we see various things on the walls. There's posters of famous Baltimore Orioles. There's like a travel brochure for the Barbados.
The Barbados.
There's
Barbados.
A
skeleton of a parrot.
A skeleton of a parrot.
You see a little postcard like from Rincon, Puerto Rico, and other little things. And then he's in the bathroom and he's just washing his like decrepit old arthritic hands. And then he just stares at himself in the mirror. And as he does, you hear these faint sounds. They're like way, way off in the distance. Sounds of fire and screams, inhuman growls, cries for help, but also like beautiful music, glasses clinking, helicopter blades, and the distinct sound of a running shower. And from there, we see a car pull up to a cemetery. And this same old man gets out, and it's winter. There's like snow all over the ground. And he's got a winter coat on, like a trench coat. And he gets out in the sun, even though it's cold out, the sun's out. And so he winces at the sun for a second and then reaches into his overcoat, pulls out a glasses case, and opens it up and produces a set of black aviators. And he puts them on his frail little face and then walks through the snow throughout the cemetery. And we see him passing several headstones until he comes to one and stops. And I imagine we're seeing this from like behind the headstone, looking up at him, staring at it. And he takes off his glove and he places a hand on the stone and just takes a deep breath in. And then he reaches into his trench coat and pulls out like a little Baltimore Orioles pennant and sticks it into the ground next to the headstone. And maybe it's at that moment we see at least the last name of the person on the headstone. It says Comstone. And then from there, the same guy pulls up to like a park. Maybe it's Washington Square Park. Something like that. He gets out and walks through an area where there's several people playing chess outdoors in the park. And, you know, there's piles of snow where the city has like left space for people to be able to walk through the park or use the chess boards. And the man sits down with like a little case and just waits, still has his aviators on. And maybe after a minute or so, we hear footsteps and someone else comes up and sits down across from him. And as the person sits down into frame, it's Jordy Arsenal.
Oh.
And he's exactly the same age that he was when we last saw him at like the end of season 2.
2019.
Yeah, or whatever it was, season 2 or season 3. He's exactly the same age. And he opens up his chess case and he has all these white chess pieces. And this old man that we've been following, he pulls out a case that's full of black pieces and does the same. And maybe we see very quickly there's like an inscription inside of the chess case that says, to my king, love, but we can't see who it's from. And this man and Jordy, they don't say anything to each other, but they just start putting their pieces out on the board. And as the first old man pulls out the queen piece, his like shaking fingers, like he rubs them over the lines and the angles of the queen and then puts it on the board. And then he reaches for the black king and he regards it for a moment. And as he does, we hear those sounds again, the fire, the screams, the growls, the shower running. And he closes his hand over the piece as if to silence it. And then we just see him place it next to the queen. Then we fade out.
Nice.
Man.
Nice.
Ripe old age.
Oh, man. That's great. That's great.
Stick around for a minute. I'll tell you about how Jordy Arsenault was in this campaign and never appeared because of choices you guys made.
Oh, no. What?
Stick around to the end for that little nugget. Let's go to Vicky. Do you have any parting thoughts, or do you want that to be your last image? You and Sam walking off into the city, you know, on a beautiful sunny day.
That's
fine. But if there's something else you want to tell, the way Roger did, you're welcome to.
I think there's just like there's been so many timelines. There's this ending, which is the movie that most people saw. But if you were a big fan and you waited a few years, there was an extended director's cut re-release. And the director, Zack Snyder style, was like, you should have been in it. It should have been 6 hours long. But they cut it because they were like, the audience really liked this ending. But the other ending is Vicky does go to Christopher with Sam. And basically she surrenders herself. She tells Christopher everything, which absolutely makes her sound insane. And she knows, like she has some, she knows, she understands what's going on, and she has enough wherewithal to hold on to the feeling that she was feeling in the grand ballroom, which was that she is an unfit mother. And she brought Sam into such extreme danger. And has always. She feels guilty for so many things. For divorce with Christopher. For marrying Roger and then divorcing Roger. For having Sam have such like a tumultuous childhood. Supernatural stuff aside. But then this on top of it. Knowing that she released the play into our world and timeline. Selfishly to save herself and her son, who never should have been there in the first place, and it was entirely her fault. So she tells Christopher everything, begs him not to put her in a place like Dorchester House, begs him not to put her in a mental institute, knowing that she wouldn't survive there. And Christopher does understand, and I think he works within the CIA, within his networking world, to put her in a sort of like witness protection thing. Like she tells law enforcement about everything that happened in Massachusetts. I assume they are looking for her. I assume there's a bunch of shit going on in 2015. So she works with them to give them names of people, sort of fabricate, doesn't talk about like Delta Green, but sort of fabricates this, military, extra non-governmental military, like Barbas and like, you know, all these people who are part of it, working against the U.S. government, you know, some shit. Puts her in witness protection, and she lives in Virginia in a facility that is not a mental facility, but she lives with like aides and constant therapy. She's allowed to see Sam sometimes. And she...
It's terrible that she got AIDS.
No.
She lives with AIDS.
The story just kept getting sad.
No.
You didn't have to, like, leave the audience on such a sad note.
All of this, and she's...
And she got AIDS? On top of that, she got AIDS.
But she's living with it, though.
She blames Roger...
She blames Roger.
All that unprotected sex with Roger, probably.
Roger.
She has live-in AIDS, is what I meant to say. But, and she starts writing. She starts writing sort of memoir-esque pieces. And I imagine, Joe, these writings are like House of Leaves. These writings are like stories within stories, a play within a novel. It's a memoir that turns into almost a transcript of dialogue between two characters that are referenced later in a different time period. And she herself is confused. She never regains all of her sanity. She battles with her mental, she forgets. She forgets a lot. She re-remembers things incorrectly. She lives out the rest of her life in comfort,
but always wonders if there was a way she could have changed things better, if she had more control, if she had done a better job. Did she make the right choices? Could she have altered the past? Was there a secret solution if she had gotten her bottle? You know, all these things that sometimes come to her in states of clarity. But we see her looking out a window in Virginia. She's near the water. It's very beautiful. And sometimes in the early morning or the late evening, dusk and dawn, she feels like she sees two moons.
And we fade out from there. Some people may wonder how, and by some people I mean me, how Vicky, in any logical reality, could not be assassinated by Delta Green after all of this. But I do know why. Vicky, it seems, has some sort of luck, fate, perhaps protection from on high. Something she never knew, but something that explains how no Delta Green agent, no matter how much research they did, could ever find the links back to Vicky and could never find her in witness protection. Could never make their way quite to her. Perhaps someone was working the strings. And we return to the palace one last time. As the music rises and crescendos, as people buzz and gossip and stand in line, as people pass across to the guards outside their invitations to the their invitations to the party. Join us at the palace, a masquerade to celebrate the new king. Come to dine, come to dance, come. And we flow into the ever ongoing party that happens every night, over and over, with the same results, except this time as we roll over the faces, we see the royal family sitting high, a man at arms standing in charge of all of the guards, now in a full red plush outfit with gold trim, in charge of all of the guards protecting the king, and sitting now centered within the royal family atop the throne, the unmistakable shape of Neil. Wearing a crown and a mask, and up above his head, a large painting of an endless hallway with a girl in front, wet and soaked from being recently drowned, with a porcelain mask over her face, her arms held up by puppet strings. And the party goes on. The end.
Oh, man.
As we fade out, and of course, do our credits. Our credits for the fucking Impossible Landscapes. Great job, everybody.
This is going to haunt me for the rest of my life.
I know, right? It's so crazy. But amazing job. Amazing how the die sort of shook out at the end there to tell these final stories. But I love it. 55 episodes. Let's go through how this all came to be and who made this possible. Impossible Landscapes is a Delta Green campaign published by Arc Dream Publishing, written by Dennis Detweiler, developed and edited by Dennis Detweiler, Shane Ivey, and Stephen Buck. Dennis Detweiler is also the art director and illustrator, all those things on that board. Dennis Ivey, there are bastard. Also graphic designs from Jen McCleary that you saw up there. There was also stuff, well, we'll get into that in a second. Technical production and post-production on Get in the Trunk, all these episodes, is done by CJ Pascal. Thank you, CJ. Our production coordinator is Michael Meridian, and a special thank you to Michael Meridian and CJ Pascal for the creation of the Impossible Landscapes promos that you would see sometimes playing in episodes of Gatewalkers.
characters and stuff like that. They created those. They were awesome. Also, a special thank you to Matt Jones, Tristan Irons, and Shane Ivy for story, graphics, and many other contributions along the way. Huge thank you to Brian McDermott, co-GM of this campaign, who helped me along the way, of course, wrote a lot of story and a lot of great stuff especially season 4 in the Night Floors. McDermott was absolutely amazing. Okay, and now I have to do this because I'm sorry, I love an epic campaign and I love a good credit scene. We have images come up, right? These images, they're still images of beautiful artwork, whether it could be sketches, they could be like paintings, but it's stills of what I'm describing here. You pick it in whatever art style you like, but we see...
It's like the end of Return of the King with the...
Yes, like Return of the King. So it could be a sketch like that if you like, or if you want it more like comic booky, like Into the Multiverse or whatever, like something like that could be cool. Lots of colors, lots of shading, whatever. You see an image of Jordy Arsenault just sitting at a chess table in Washington Square Park, and it comes up. It says Jordy Arsenault, created by Skid Marr. And then you see Roger and Dr. Lyra Westover in like the hospital. Like in a moment of recognition where they're both like kind of recognizing each other, but they're between worlds. And then it cuts to her. We see her super, super old in a wheelchair in like a vegetative state. And then we see one more of her sitting in a cafe sipping a coffee in 1971, a file out on a table in front of her. Dr. Lyra Westover, created by Matthew Capodicasa.
Yes.
Then we see Neil sitting in front of a movie house with a mic taking questions from an audience after a premiere. Then we see Neil sitting in an art gallery examining a painting of Washington Square Park that was painted by Abigail Wright. And then we see him frozen in time in a bank among all these deposit boxes, putting a crown, frozen in the moment of putting a crown onto his head. Dr. Neil Bachman, created and played by Skid Marr. We see Bobby playing chess in Washington Square Park with Mr. Kremensky. We see frozen in time, the moment Bobby is running to try to get around the clown. And the clown just barely touches him as he's trying to get the patsuit to Neil, like frozen in time. And then we see Bobby in a war-torn apartment, dressed in World War II fatigues, listening to a backpack radio and trying to break a code. Robert Walford, created and played by Francis Marema. We see Vicky up late at night in her apartment going through files on the Abigail Wright missing persons case. Then we see her behind the wheel, gritting her teeth through a gunshot wound in a car chase in Boston. And then we see her holding a gun up on an airplane, shooting Ace Darabondi in the back. Get the fucking job done. Vicky Ricci, created and played by Sidney Emanuel.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we see Roger from the back. Gigantic back. Standing in front of a wall filled with pictures, newspaper clippings, evidence with a big sign over the top of it that just says, home, with a question mark. We see him strapped upright in a patient bed, fearlessly looked staring down Dr. Maximo Friend as he's bringing a needle up to put it into his eye.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
And then we see Roger Comstone standing in an endless hallway with two loaded shotguns and a bag over his shoulder with cash spilling out of it. It just says, Roger Comstone, created and played by Troy LaValle. Yay! Nice. And then finally, some words from the campaign. And so we come to our end of sorts, a play that contains multitudes, all who died, all who live, all who yet shall, upon this stage, with us, forever, until we begin it all again. Curtain. That's literally the last word of the campaign.
Wow.
Curtain, which I think is great. Awesome. So, anyway, great job, guys. No epilogue scenes because it is over. But two epilogue notes. One, I had Skid record a voicemail message as Jordy Arsenault to one of the tenants of the building, because in the actual campaign, the tenant was a screenwriter and sci-fi fantasy author. Oh, and no. So I was like, wouldn't it be cool if they were connected?
Yes.
I gave Skid no context. And also, that guy's name was Roger. So I had Skid, I said, I need you to record a message to Roger and just say these things. And he did an amazing job. It sounded so great. Maybe we'll release it to subscribers or something.
Oh my God,
but it was a perfect little thing. And you never investigated that apartment. That was one apartment door you just never happened to open.
I totally forgot about that.
You never made it into the adventure. But Jordy had a connection with one. He's calling and leaving a message because his friend has not gotten back to him. He's basically vanished. And so he's calling him to find out, you know, what's going on. And then one last just like friendly note, especially on this National Day of Kindness. I went back to, in preparation for this, and listened to a good chunk of the first episode of Impossible Landscapes of season 4, episode 1, and go back and watch it. The first 3 minutes of the damn episode. It's amazing. Because we bring Francis in to his first campaign. He did not know. He says on air, he did not know it was a campaign. He said, this is a campaign? So this is going to be like a long thing? And I say, you're locked in for several years, my friend. And he goes, I'm in. And he goes, I'm making a note right now to quit my day job. And that was in Hawaii while he had a different job. And he quit his fucking day job. And he moved to New York City.
Oh, my God.
And he's in the studio right now in our studio in New York. And that's where he finished the campaign. What a great story, right?
The King in Yellow commands
me. That's cool.
The King in Yellow commands me.
I can't wait to see what's next for Francis on the network. This is just awesome. So,
Joe, we have to say thank you to you, Joe.
Yes.
For being such a wonderful handler, for putting up with us for 3 years. And I can't wait. We keep saying we're all going to read this AP. Well, at least me and Skid. Not so sure about Troy and Francis. But
I'm going to need some distance before I get back.
I can't wait to see what you and McDermott cooked up and what changed and how you went with us on our tangent. So thank you for being such a wonderful handler.
Yeah. Yes.
You're great job.
You painted pictures that are like seared into my mind, like seriously, just with words, and it's fucking amazing.
Agreed.
Thank you, Sydney. That's so nice. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it so much. Thank you to the audience, everybody who's watched this on YouTube, everybody who's listened on the podcast for all this time. Can't say we'll see you next week. We'll see you at some point. Thank you so much for listening. It has been a wonderful journey with you, but this concludes Impossible Landscapes. We'll see you some other time. Take
it
easy, everybody.
Let's go get drinks, guys.
Let's go get drinks. We'll see you soon, Nation, one way or another. Goodbye. Goodbye.